And this morning, I want to talk about what's so amazing about grace. If you were here last week, talked about this part, kind of a part one, and wanted to follow some of that up this week. A number of people came to me at the end of the meeting last week and were saying, oh, look, this is really helpful. Often we think about grace, those of us who've been around for a long time. We think we understand what grace is, but there's always new things to learn. And you know, it's the truth is that it's not what's new that sets you free, it's what's true that sets you free. And there's something about the truth in grace that we can learn together. And I guess my hope and my prayer is that as I speak for a few moments, that we pick up the themes of our morning. You know, as we pray before our morning meeting, we always we're praying that God would come and speak to us, that He would give us the now word. And already you'll have picked up the themes in our worship, this sense of the storm thing. Well, we want to respond to that, don't we? There's something significant this morning, I believe, as we listen, we wait on God and we hear what He has to speak to us. So we'll include that in our, make sure that we leave time to respond to that as well. And last week talked about this this thing, amazing grace. And I'm not going to go over everything that I spoke about last week, but started with a definition. There's lots of definitions of grace, but this is the one that is probably the closest to the biblical definition, that grace is free and unmerited favor of God. Or other people often describe it as getting what we don't deserve. And it's free, it's unmerited, and of course, things that I said this last week, things that are free, most of us like things that are free. Everybody in the room likes free stuff. The problem with things that are free is that actually most of us think that if it sounds like it's too good to be true, it normally is too good to be true. So you click on the link when you get the email through which says you can have this amazing free stuff. And normally, in order to get to the free stuff, you have to subscribe to something for a million years, or you have to click on something else, and you have to buy some new hat in order for you to be able to benefit from the free stuff. How many people have sometimes clicked on those emails and not been quite so impressed? The reason that it sounds too good to be true is normally because it is. And that's often why I think we have a problem with grace, because grace, if we're honest, sounds too good to be true. And in our experience, if it sounds too good to be true, then it probably is, and therefore we are not going to benefit from it. And last week, as we finished our time together, the last thing we read was Romans chapter 5, which says this. It says, therefore, since we have been, this is a great grace message, passage. It says, therefore, since we've been made right in God's sight by faith, we have peace with God because of what Jesus Christ our Lord has done for us. Because of our faith, Christ has brought us into the place of undeserved privilege, or in other words, grace, where we now stand and we confidently and joyfully look forward to sharing God's glory. And I said as we finished that I love the way the Message paraphrase puts it. The last part, it says, we find ourselves standing where we always hoped we might stand, out in the wide open spaces of God's grace and glory, standing tall and shouting our praise. And I love this paraphrase that Eugene Peterson uses. And of course, there's some images which maybe some of us who are image people rather than word people, there are some images that are really helpful, aren't there, in terms of wide open spaces. How many people have been away on holiday and there's just something that is just so wonderful about standing and looking at a great expanse of space. That's why I think many of us love looking at the sea. I know there's people in the room who love sitting on the beach and looking at the sea. Something about the expanse, it speaks to us, doesn't it, of God's immenseness, the size, the how awesome our God is. And this picture, therefore, of the image of grace being wide open spaces, what does wide open mean? It means, well, not restrictive, it's not constrictive, and that's what grace is for us in our lives. Well, what's the opposite of that? Well, I guess it's restrictive, constrictive, enclosed spaces where we aren't free. And what does that look like? Often it feels like we're trapped, doesn't it? Prison indeed. And so this morning I want to talk a bit more about grace, but I want us to think about freedom, and I want us to think about open spaces and closed spaces. And The Bible passage that I want to have a think about for a few moments is in John chapter 8. It can come up on the screen, or you can find it for yourselves if you want to. And this is a story out of John's Gospel. And starting in verse 1, it says, Jesus returned to the Mount of Olives, but early the next morning he was back again at the temple. A crowd soon gathered, and he sat down and taught them. As he was speaking, the teachers of religious law and the Pharisees brought a woman who'd been caught in the act of adultery. They put her in front of the crowd. Teacher, they said to Jesus, this woman was caught in the act of adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say? They were trying to trap him into saying something that they could use against him. So what's happening here? Well, Jesus is in town. He's on a mission to teach people and point people towards God. That's his big mission. And John, one of Jesus' friends, John describes himself, the man, the disciple that Jesus loved. He's on a mission too, and his mission is to explain to his readers that Jesus is God. And he's basically saying to his readers that actually, if you want to see what God looks like, then look at Jesus. And if you want to know what God thinks, then look at Jesus and you'll know what God thinks. So if we want to know how God deals with awkward situations, then watch out here and we'll find out, because we'll see what Jesus does. I guess most of us have found ourselves in uncomfortable, awkward situations before. And I think if you put yourself in this story, in this picture, you'd have to agree that this is a pretty awkward situation. Awkward for lots of people, lots of different reasons. This lady is brought into the temple. She probably was brought half naked, totally humiliated, ashamed. And just as an aside, the law in the law, what should have happened was both people should have been brought forward. That's what actually should have happened. So I don't know where, you know, adultery normally involves more than one person, doesn't it? I don't know how the guy got away with it, but anyway. This lady comes before Jesus. And the Pharisees, it seems, they're not too worried about this woman personally, because their aim, of course, is to try and trap Jesus. If this woman gets killed along the way, then so be it, I guess. In fact, that was what the law wanted, and the Pharisees wanted to uphold the law, so this was what they were after. That was what would have been expected. And that's the context, that's the situation that this story finds ourselves in. And some of you, of course, you know the end of the story, so you know where we're heading, but maybe not everyone does. But before we answer the question of what did Jesus do, then let me ask you a question. What would you do? There's a number of options, aren't there, if you're in this position. And we would take on different roles, but one option, of course, is to let this woman off. Sounds pretty compassionate, doesn't it? I'm not asking for a show of hands this morning, but maybe that's certainly one option, isn't it? To release her, to send her away. Sounds kind, sounds compassionate. They're both in the Bible, so maybe pretty good option. We don't know much about this woman, but maybe she was a mother. It's Mother's Day, so maybe that's another reason she could get that off. Otherwise, option two, well, maybe you say, well, kindness is all very well, but the truth is she has messed up. You know, if you do a rule check, then her situation is not favorable, is it? And I know that there are plenty of people around who like rules. I mean, rules aren't bad, are they? Some rules are pretty good, can be helpful. And maybe in your job, maybe you're surrounded by rules. Anybody? My title when I'm in the office, for the days I'm in the office, is UK Manufacturing Controller. Sounds very grand. Don't know what it means. Something to do with finance, I think, which is an odd description, but that's what happens if you work for a European company, I think. But a lot of my job involves Well, some of it involves compliance, making sure that we as a company are in control. We want to be safe from the problems that we could otherwise face. So the right people doing the right things at the right time in the right places. There's lots of rules around. And I guess those of us who are in organisations, how many people have seen the number of rules increase over the years? We're surrounded by rules, aren't we? I know I've got other finance colleagues in the room, and Elaine is smiling now because she knows about Sarbanes-Oxley. And that's an accountant's reference, and there's only and Andy probably as well. So anyway, Sarbanes-Oxley, probably not relevant for the rest of you. And of course, rules, pretty important for parenting. How many people in the room? Well, we know we've already honoured the mothers, but parenting rules can be important, aren't they? And you'll find that within a family unit, there are some people who will adhere to the rules more closely than others, aren't there? There's some people who like to back up the rules. They're the rule masters, if you like, keeping a strict eye on what is done and what isn't done. And then there's some people who are perhaps a bit more flexible on the rules. Do you know those different kinds of parenting? Anyone? And maybe we look at the rules in our society and we say, well, what could help our society? Would it be more rules? Is that what we need? More rules and more punishment following the rules? Or maybe we need something, maybe we need less rules, or maybe we need more grace. Well, last week we looked briefly at some of the rules that existed in the Old Testament. And of course, this finds us the context of this story today, because the Pharisees are bringing up another bunch of rules. And we read last week from the book of Leviticus in the Old Testament. And I said, if you're new to the Bible, I don't suggest that you start in Leviticus, but start with the words of Jesus first. But then Leviticus, after you've read the stuff about Jesus, Leviticus is a fascinating read. And in the light of reading about Jesus, there's lots of things which make a lot of sense in the book of Leviticus. But Leviticus and other books in the Old Testament talk about rules. In fact, over 600 rules. There's a little bit of homework for anyone who wants to go away and find them. Over 600 rules in the Old Testament. How many people think that the rules back then were pretty significant too? And of course, the rules were from God for people. So they weren't bad necessarily, because they were God's idea. But what's the purpose of rules? I was thinking about this week. Well, rules aren't bad, as we've said, but rules can't save anyone. The best a rule or a law can do is set a boundary and threaten punishment for crossing that boundary. People still have to decide whether to obey the rule or not. And when it comes to parents, think about this. If we're not careful, we make rules out of fear. How many people have done that in the past? And of course, that doesn't work. We put rules in place to try and keep our kids on the straight and narrow. But that's not what rules are for. Rules are meant to lead us to relationship, not to replace relationship. And I think that is so important. And as an aside, maybe if you're a parent, then I would say this: focusing too much on rules, this is just a little handy thought or a hint, focusing too much on rules and too little on grace tells children that what they do is more important than who they are. And we all need help, those of us who are parents, don't we? And I'm not saying this morning that there's no need for boundaries for children. I think it's really important. I think sometimes we don't actually have enough boundaries in place, and don't we need wisdom and grace as we do that? But we need to have these boundaries in the context of love, grace, and affirmation. So rules on their own aren't enough. And why aren't rules enough? Well, I think there's four things. There's four reasons why rules aren't enough. Rules, number one, rules are powerless. Rules just tell us what to do or what not to do, but they don't actually help us accomplish anything, do they, if you think about it? If we're not able to follow the rules, we end up feeling condemned, hopeless, which demotivates us and makes it even harder to keep the rules, doesn't it? If you've struggled with rules and then you miss it and you blow it, then you kind of feel like giving up on the rules. We'll come back to it again later, but the word grace in the Bible actually has a dual meaning. On the one hand, it refers to undeserved favor towards us, but it also refers to God's power at work in us to accomplish more than we could on our own. In other words, grace is God's God-giving power for us to live differently, which is pretty good. Another reason why rules aren't enough, rules are external. Rules are restrictions imposed on us by others or by ourselves. Sometimes we put our own rules on ourselves, don't we? They're usually meant to stop us from doing what we want or to motivate us to do what we don't want. So what do rules do? They deal with behavior, but they don't deal with the heart. They don't adjust attitudes. They're external. But grace, on the other hand, is internal. It works on a heart level. Where rules attempt to force us to do the opposite of what we want, grace actually changes what we want, and we'll come back to that later. Number three, rules just point us towards ourselves. If you think about it, rules and regulations, they just focus in on us, don't they? If we focus on and think about, if we're looking at a holiness to-do list, we'll tend to find ourselves making comparisons, looking at we're self-sufficient because we're sticking to the rules, and it all points inwards to ourselves. But of course, those of us who've tried to live like that, well, sooner or later we realize we can't do it, and then we swing towards condemnation because we go, I can't do it, I've blown it. And condemnation is not a good place to sit, and I can see people nodding in the room. The last thing, why rules aren't enough. Rules are often, I've already mentioned it, rules are often based on fear. Most rules are only any good if there's some sort of reward or punishment basis, isn't it? We obey because we're afraid of missing out on the reward, or we're afraid of being punished. And that's fine in some, it works, doesn't it? In some relationships, you know, employer and employee, there needs to be some confines and constraints, and it's right. And maybe teacher and student, you know, there are some things where actually it's important to have reward, and there needs to be, people need to be aware of consequences. But of course, it's not healthy for father-child relationships, which is what our relationship is with God. If we're operating out of fear, then that's not a good place for us to be. And think about the wide open spaces. Well, what do? Rules just trap us, don't they? They just bring everything in. Where we have wide open spaces, suddenly we're forced into a place that is constrictive. It's restrictive. But it's true, rules aren't enough, but rules aren't all bad. It's really important to hear that. But grace, and this is the key, is so much better. If rules are all about us and they're external and they point towards ourselves and they're powerless and they're based on fear, then grace is all about Jesus. And as we get to know him more, and we prayed this morning in our pre-meeting, we want to become more like him, and that's what grace does in our lives, and it's wonderful, and of course that's why it's so amazing. So if we go back to the story, what does Jesus do to deal with this situation? Well, remember, it's actually a trap for Jesus. That's the context. That's where we find ourselves picking up the story. The Pharisees know that Jesus by now has got a reputation for forgiving people, releasing people from shame. They've seen it happen already. But also a reputation for knowing the law. And according to the law, this woman should be killed. So it's a difficult position for him to be in. Let's see what happens. So, teacher, they said to Jesus, this woman was caught in adultery. The law of Moses says to stone her. What do you say? They were trying to trap him into saying something they could use against him. But Jesus stooped down, wrote in the dust with his finger. They kept demanding an answer. So he stood up again and said, all right, but let the one who's never sinned throw the first stone. Then he stooped down again and wrote in the dust. When the accusers heard this, they slipped away one by one, beginning with the oldest. until only Jesus was left in the middle of the crowd with the woman. Then Jesus stood up again and said to the woman, "Where are your accusers? Didn't even one of them condemn you?" "No, Lord," she said. And Jesus said, fantastic words, "Neither do I. Go and sin no more." And there's lots of speculation and thoughts, and I don't know about you, when I read some of these stories, some questions about what was he writing in the dust, and there are some theories we don't really know. Maybe some people think that he was actually writing down the names of the accusers and some of their sins. He was pointing the finger back at them, basically. That's one suggestion. But either way, whatever happened, we see that what Jesus does is, as ever, as we'd expect, is brilliant. He deals with a situation, he responds graciously, doesn't he? He doesn't condemn, but he also doesn't condone what this lady has done. He uses the word sin no more. He sets her free from the law that was trapping her through amazing grace. Don't you love Jesus? And if we want to know why he did that, we can see at the very start of John's gospel, his message in the first chapter, he says these words. He says, "The word became flesh and made his dwelling among us. We have seen his glory, the glory of the one and only Son who came from the Father." He says these words, "full of grace and truth." And then in verse 16, out of his fullness, we have all received grace in place of grace already given. For the law was given through Moses, grace and truth came through Jesus Christ. So we can see here that here's the beginning of the superseding, if you like, of the law. Jesus came to fulfill it, but he came to demonstrate that actually the way that he would respond, this is the way that God would respond, was with grace and with truth. And I love the fact that Jesus was full of both. They're not enemies. Sometimes it feels like grace and truth contradict, but they can't be because Jesus was full of both, it says. So if we want to know truth and we want to know grace, then we just need more of Jesus, right? And I think we do. There's one other definition of grace. Well, there's lots of others, but there's one other by a man named Jack Hayford, an influential Christian leader in America. He says this, and I think this is really helpful. Grace is God meeting us at our point of need in the person of Jesus Christ. Think about that for a minute. In other words, we need help. So God gives us grace at the place we need it most. And grace has a name, and it's Jesus. Grace has a name, and it's Jesus. And in a moment, we'll pray and invite a response. But just before we do that, I guess whenever we talk about grace, and particularly on stories like this, it's important just to add a word of caution. Because, and we see this in the New Testament, some of the churches started to get hold of what grace looked like, and it looked like this whole sense of being released from the law. And some people were saying, well, actually, what does this mean then? If I'm going to receive grace, then I can go on sinning. I might as well sin. I might as well benefit from this grace. And in Romans, Paul says, what shall we say then? Shall we go on sinning? This is what people were saying, so that grace may increase. This kind of sense, well, we might as well. It doesn't matter, does it? But of course, that's not right. But in other words, they're saying, if God's going to forgive me anyway, then it doesn't matter. Might as well carry on. And if grace means that we don't live under rules anymore, the law anymore, we live under grace, then we might as well go ahead and continue to sin. That's what the people were saying. And you can see why that argument came about, because if you emphasize grace, that's where we could end up. And of course, if grace is just a principle, then maybe that sounds okay. But if grace is really a person and it's Jesus, then of course you might abuse a principle, but you would never abuse a person, would you? So if Jesus is grace himself, then our motivation for not sinning is not because of rules, it's not because of principles, it's actually because we don't want to sin because grace is the person and its name is Jesus. And if this definition of grace is God meeting us at our point of need in the person of Jesus, what does that mean? Well, I think it means two things. Grace gives us the power to live differently, and grace gives us the motivation to live differently too. So that's what's so amazing about grace, because it gives us the power when we had no power. It gives us the motivation when maybe we lacked motivation. So today, if grace is God meeting us at our point of need in the person of Jesus Christ, then what's your point of need? Where does the person of Jesus need to meet with you today? And we've already talked about storms, and maybe this morning there's a personal storm in your life. Maybe there's a situation that you can identify as the storm. And maybe this morning that is your point of need, where you need to know the grace that is Jesus. And maybe that's our response this morning, that we recognize that grace is the power to live differently and also our motivation too. And of course, as we've said so many times already this year, that of course, as we respond for ourselves, there's also an outworking beyond that. There's also a consequence that goes far beyond that. Because if we receive and we know and we're aware of God's grace, what does that mean that we do? It means that we live differently, which has a consequence on the people around us. It has a consequence on the choices that we make, the conversations that we have in our communities, in our church, in this place, in our life groups. Those of you who are part of life groups, all of this affects that, doesn't it? And let's be like Jesus. You can't help but look at this story and say, well, I want to be like that, can you? Right in the middle of this particular storm, Jesus responds so wonderfully, doesn't he? And how many of us are aware of the judgmental attitudes that surround us so many times? And yet Jesus, right in the middle of that storm, responds with grace and truth, releases this woman who, I mean, for her, the consequence was severe, and she's released literally from being stoned on that day. That's what would have happened. So for her, the consequence is huge. But she was also set free, not just from physical death, but also spiritual death, if you like, as she gets restored, she gets put back to a place where she is affirmed, and Jesus does all of that with just one action.